Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Early in the week, a group of some 30 Democrats in Congress drafted a letter to the Biden administration urging greater emphasis on seeking a diplomatic resolution to the conflict in Ukraine. It did not oppose arming Ukraine, and it condemned the Russian invasion unequivocally, but it urged that the U.S. seek negotiations toward a ceasefire as a step toward ending the conflict without unnecessary further bloodshed. Like many progressives, I felt the letter was perfectly reasonable, but the authors received swift and intense pushback from fellow Democrats, forcing Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal to formally withdraw the letter, claiming that it had become a distraction in light of the Republican pledges to cut aid to Ukraine if they take control in the midterm elections. For those of us on the left, the situation presents some unique challenges. We're accustomed to viewing U.S. military interventions through a relatively partisan lens, given the long history of the U.S. support for anti-democratic regimes and its opposition to democratic aspirations in many parts of the globe. Rarely are we presented with such a clear case of an unwarranted and criminal act of aggression by another nation toward a country within the U.S. sphere of political influence. No one denies that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is just that, a colossal crime of horrific proportions. It is not even comparable in scale to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, which was the pretense used by the U.S. to attack and later occupy Iraq. There is, however, a parallel in terms of the U.S. role leading up to both invasions. Surely those invasions were anticipated, and in both cases not really discouraged. In retrospect, it is now almost a foregone conclusion among progressives that the U.S. engineered the circumstances in Iraq because it wanted a reason to launch that war, and it served some policy agenda in the region, having nothing to do with national security or obligations to political allies in the region. I think it's fair to ask the same question about Ukraine, even as we acknowledge the moral imperative to insist in Ukraine's self-defense. I, for one, do not think that the U.S. motivations in this conflict are sincere and may, in fact, be rather sinister or even at least very cynical. And yet the necessity of aiding Ukraine is not being questioned by anyone, including me. Supporting Ukraine's self-defense while criticizing U.S. foreign policy, it's not an either-or situation, but rather a both-and scenario. And that's a hard thing to wrap one's head around, especially against a backdrop of war drums being echoed by most of the media and the State Department and by fellow progressives who see any deviation from pursuit of an outright military victory for Ukraine as political heresy. I want to play an excerpt from a recent broadcast of Democracy Now! Featuring Institute for Policy Studies spokesperson Phyllis Bennis on this very topic. She had called for a negotiated preventative approach before the conflict and then a negotiated settlement to end it once it began. Here she is discussing the drafting and the withdrawal of the Progressive Caucus letter.
We begin today's show looking at the war in Ukraine and a controversy on Capitol Hill over a call for Biden to push for talks to end the Ukraine war. On Monday, the Congressional Progressive Caucus sent a letter to the White House which urged the Biden administration to pursue direct negotiations with Russia for a ceasefire in Ukraine while continuing to arm the Ukrainian military. The letter, which was signed by 30 Democrats, stated in part, quote, "We urge you to pair the military and economic support the United States has provided to Ukraine with a proactive diplomatic push, redoubling efforts to seek a realistic framework for a ceasefire. This is consistent with your recognition that there's going to have to be a negotiated settlement here, and your concern that Vladimir Putin doesn't have a way out right now, and I'm trying to figure out what we do about that," unquote. The release of the letter was soon attacked by other Democrats. Democratic Congressmember Jake Auchincloss of Massachusetts called it a, quote, "olive branch to a war criminal who's losing his war," unquote. Within a day, the Congressional Progressive Caucus withdrew the letter. Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal issued a statement saying, quote, "The letter was drafted several months ago, but unfortunately was released by staff without vetting. Because of the timing, our message is being conflated by some as being equivalent to the recent statement by Republican leader McCarthy threatening an end to aid to Ukraine if Republicans take over," unquote. Last week, Kevin McCarthy warned Republicans won't give Ukraine a, quote, "blank check" if the GOP regains control of Congress. While Jayapal withdrew the letter, some progressive lawmakers have defended the letter's message, like Congressmember Ro Khanna, who appeared on CNN Wednesday.
I have supported every package of giving aid to Ukraine, and I plan to support continuing to arm Ukraine. All the letter said is that we, at the same time that we stand with Ukraine, need to make sure that we're reducing the risk for nuclear war, that we're engaging in talks with the Russians to make sure that the conflict doesn't escalate. We need to support Ukraine with arms, and we need diplomacy. That's common sense.
This all comes as fears grow that the war in Ukraine may turn nuclear. On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin oversaw annual drills of Russia's strategic nuclear forces. Meanwhile, Politico reports the United States has moved up plans to deploy upgraded nuclear weapons to Europe. To talk more about the controversy around the Congressional Progressive Caucus's letter and what U.S. diplomatic efforts could entail, we're joined by Phyllis Bennis, author and fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her recent piece for The Progressive is headlined, "It's Time for Diplomacy." Phyllis, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you lay out what happened? Talk about the content of this letter, the fact that 30 Congress members signed on. It was released, then retracted.
Well, you know, Amy, what happened was very much reflected in Ro Khanna's statement just now. The letter was a very carefully drawn, mild letter that was very important because there had not been an official congressional statement urging the Biden administration to call for diplomacy. On the contrary, we've seen significant evidence that the administration has really not supported the idea of moving towards a diplomatic approach in Ukraine, along with the military aid that they're providing, despite the fact that there have been statements from President Biden and others that this war, like all wars, will end with some kind of diplomacy. The issue is always, at what cost and after how long? Are we going to wait until this war becomes a longstanding war of attrition, or with all of the additional deaths that that could lead to? Or are we going to say there needs to be a diplomatic component right away? Some of us, myself included, have been saying right from the beginning, my first piece on the war that was drafted just a day after the illegal Russian invasion, recognized that there was going to have to be a ceasefire then. There needed to be a ceasefire on day one, a ceasefire when Russia was succeeding in pulling in more territory to itself. It needed a ceasefire when the Ukrainians were able to seize the offensive and take back some of that territory. And we need a ceasefire now. So this letter was actually a very cautiously, mildly drafted letter that said, as Ro Khanna said, and as you indicated in reading it, that we need an additional component of policy in Ukraine that needs to include a ceasefire and diplomacy. The level of outrage that greeted this very careful, you know, sort of common sense approach shows us how much work is still needed by our movement and more broadly in society to stop the kind of control that militarism seems to have on our assumptions about what foreign policy looks like. The notion that this could be solely a situation where the U.S. continues to send tens of billions of dollars with all of the weapons that are ever required by Ukraine, to what end? What's the end game here? Those are not the questions, unfortunately, that are being asked. Instead, it was, you know, the focus has been on the timing and did the letter match the position of the Republicans, which of course it didn't. But that isn't really the important part. The important part is to look at the need for a ceasefire and diplomacy to end the war in Ukraine.
So, Phyllis, as you said, because the letter was, in some sense, quite mild, what do you think accounts for the fact that more conservative or mainstream Democrats responded with such vehemence? And what about this one brief clause in the letter that said that Putin at the moment, Russia at the moment, does not have a way out, he needs to be given a way out? What exactly would that mean?
Well, I think it means a series of steps. The first step in any of these situations is you need a ceasefire. A ceasefire is not sufficient. A ceasefire is not a guarantee that you're going to be able to end the war in a just way anytime soon. But it sets the stage that you can begin the process of negotiations. And I think what the letter was referring to in that point was that there have been public and private, from what we understand, positions taken by the U.S. administration, and it's certainly been true in Congress and in much of the mass media in this country, that says there is no room for diplomacy here, that this is going to be a war that is ended with a great Ukrainian victory. It's going to be, you know, one imagines that there is this sense it's going to be like World War II, where the war ends with a complete surrender and a flag raising and some band is playing Hail to Some Chief and everybody will be happy. It's not going to work that way. I think everybody acknowledges that who's serious about examining both the political and the military realities of this war, that there's going to have to be some kind of diplomacy. That doesn't mean that the United States, despite the fact that the U.S. is providing such enormous amounts of money and arms to Ukraine for its resistance, that doesn't mean that the U.S. has the right to tell the Ukrainians how they should engage in diplomacy, what they should concede, if anything. But it does mean that we cannot pretend that while providing $65 billion so far, overwhelmingly for the military, not quite all of it, but most of it, with another $50 billion under discussion now in Congress, and all of these weapons, all of this training, that we can then also simultaneously stand back and act like a cheerleader that's not connected to the war that's underway. The U.S. has significant issues of diplomacy that need to be raised with Russia that do not depend on what the Ukrainian decisions are about their diplomacy with Russia. The U.S. needs to be negotiating with Russia about reopening all of these abandoned nuclear and conventional arms treaties that right now pretty much don't exist at all. It makes everything much more dangerous. The U.S. needs to be negotiating with Russia on the question of what are the consequences of building a new U.S. military base in Poland less than 100 miles from the Russian border? I mean, talk about provocation. This is quite serious, and there needs to be some discussion about that. These are things that the U.S. can be negotiating with Russia that don't go to the Ukrainian position, making clear to Russia that when there is a ceasefire, the U.S.-imposed sanctions will begin to be lifted, is crucial because without that, there's no real incentive for Russia. While the sanctions are in place, I assume that they are looking to the precedent the U.S. set in Iraq when it made very clear at the United Nations that at a certain point it didn't matter whether Saddam Hussein allowed in the U.N. inspectors or not. The sanctions were simply not going to be lifted anyway. That took away any incentive that the sanctions may ever have had to encourage a change in behavior. There needs to be U.S.-Russian negotiations on all of those issues, which are not dependent on the views of Ukraine, which, of course, are crucial in determining the nature of the longstanding need for real diplomacy to end this war. But first, there needs to be a ceasefire to allow all that to go forward.
So, Phyllis, let's just talk about what attempts, if any, significant ones, there have been to reach a ceasefire, either initiated by the Europeans. It's Macron in France who has sustained conversation with the Russians since the invasion and even prior to it. Just this past weekend, Lloyd Austin had conversations with his Russian counterpart. Although no details were released of their conversation, the one thing that was told about the conversation, the one detail that was revealed, is that Austin reportedly emphasized the importance of maintaining lines of communication between Russia and the U.S. Their conversation was the first in several months. In May, they spoke—May was the last time they spoke. And again, reportedly, the U.S. did press for a ceasefire, which the Russians rejected on the grounds that the U.S. is not willing to talk to the Russians as equals. In talks with NATO countries, Turkey, France and Britain, who to varying degrees have urged a ceasefire, Russia has been unwilling to budge. These are according to news reports in Europe as well as here. So your response to that, how can pressure be brought to bear on Russia, which is, of course, the aggressor in this war?
Russia is indeed the aggressor in this war on the ground. There is a question of the larger, longer-lasting geopolitical war that's underway that goes back many, many years, in which the U.S. and NATO have played a very provocative role against Russia. But there is no question that none of those provocations justified any of the Russian moves. This is Russian aggression, pure and simple. I think there are reports that have other views as well that indicate both British and perhaps other NATO reports about indications that there is not support for a ceasefire coming from NATO and the US, other U.S. allies. I think that the fact that all of these reports are based on evidence of discussions with diplomats and with others that are not identified, that can't be confirmed, it makes it very difficult to know, is there actually support among NATO leaders for a ceasefire or not? There were certainly reports about the role of Boris Johnson going to meet with President Zelensky and urging him not to consider a ceasefire. I don't think that Zelensky is necessarily getting only one position from his allies. He is, of course, completely dependent on NATO and particularly on the United States for both economic and military support. But I think that the question needs to be raised to our own government, which is playing such a crucial role in this war, about the need to support a ceasefire immediately and longer-term negotiations to end the war. The meetings that you referenced between the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and his Russian counterpart was very important, not meeting a telephone call, because there had not been communication since last May. And that makes things particularly dangerous on the question of the potential escalation to a nuclear exchange, which is what makes the war in Ukraine so incredibly dangerous, so much more dangerous globally than any of the horrific wars we've seen over the last 20 years, more than the war in Iraq, more than the war in Afghanistan, despite the horrific level of destruction that was wrought in those countries by the U.S. invasions and occupations. Those wars never threatened to erupt into a globally impactful nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia, which together, of course, control 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world. In the situation of Ukraine, that's very different. There is a threat of that kind of escalation. And what we don't have in Ukraine right now is what the U.S. speaks of as a deconfliction line, which basically means a direct line of communication, a hotline, telephone, whether by computer of whatever form, that we did have, for example, in Syria, when you had a history of the U.S. and Russia supporting proxy forces on opposite sides. And they made sure that while neither Russia in Aleppo or the United States in Raqqa, for instance, where those two cities were destroyed by the two global powers, the U.S. and Russia didn't care very much whether they killed enormous numbers of Syrian civilians, which they did with their bombing in those two cities. But they were both very concerned about not killing the other side. The U.S. did not want to kill any Russian soldiers. The Russians were just as concerned that they not kill any U.S. soldiers or pilots or whatever. And as a result, they had a direct means of communication to call off any mistaken escalation and to warn the other side when they were planning to bomb in a certain area, saying, we're going to bomb in X place, get your people out of there. And it worked. We don't have that in Ukraine. And that means things are much more dangerous in terms of a potential escalation, maybe with neither side actually intending to use a nuclear weapon. And right now, I don't see any evidence that either Putin nor President Biden have any intention of using nuclear weapons. But the fact that there have been these statements from Russia that seem to imply pretty directly a nuclear threat, as well as potentially a threat of the use of other non-conventional weapons, chemical, nuclear, whatever, or biological. And for the U.S., of course, a very provocative move, sending 100 upgraded versions of one of the most commonly deployed nuclear weapons in Europe. There are now, of course, 5 countries in Europe, NATO members, that are holding U.S. nuclear weapons under U.S. control in their territory. They now are being upgraded. That's a deliberate nuclear escalation. That's a deliberate nuclear threat. So the threats are coming from both sides. I don't believe either president has any intention of using a nuclear weapon. But when there are nuclear weapons involved, until they are abolished, when they are involved in this theater of war, and the two nuclear powers are directly engaged, the threat of a nuclear escalation is dramatic, no matter how small it is. If it's anything other than zero, that's way too high a risk to take.
I'd like to hear what Medea Benjamin has to say about the withdrawal of that letter, but we don't yet have a reply on that. She did, however, visit Columbus a couple of weeks ago as part of her national book tour promoting a recently published book on the Ukraine conflict. Our engineer Eugene Beer was there to record it and will present one part of her talk today and the rest in a subsequent broadcast. It begins with an introduction by Mark Stansbury.
We are getting close to $100 billion by the U.S. being spent on this war. $100 billion. We're like, what, $70 billion right now? So $100 billion we're going to be spending on. And we're going to be spending $1 trillion on the military this year. And that doesn't count with the Ukraine war. So it may be even more than that. You know, so U.S. taxpayers, where are you? Where's the voice of opposition that U.S. taxpayers always talk about when they are saying their money's being misspent? But we'll hear more about that. So Medea's on a book tour right now. And please, we have books here. I hope some of the folks from the other room that are in here drinking coffee would want to come in and listen a little bit. But again, Medea Benjamin is part of Code Pink and also Global Exchange. Has been to the area and the region, and actually, I guess, while writing the book, she discovered she may even have a little Ukrainian in her blood, which she said so that's puts a little bit more blood into the book, as we say. We're not going to get going yet because I see Krista and a few other folks coming, so we're. We'll get going here in the 2 seconds, but I just wanted to thank everybody for coming out. It's good crew that we got here. We are at a point in the United States where there's no peace movement. No one's talking about what's going on. No challenge to the authority of the direction we're heading as a society. So, again, thank you for coming out. Enjoy ourselves. We're going to be in a conversation, a discussion, and a community dialogue. Medea has some prepared remarks that she'll be saying. The book is here available. Please do that.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. It's great to be here. I think the way we'll do it tonight, because we're recording this for the radio, is that instead of giving more remarks in the beginning now, we'll go quickly into this video, and then I'll talk, and then we'll have the discussion. So the book is I see it as kind of a primer, like the basics, so that when people ask you some basic questions, you will have the answers. And I wrote it precisely for that reason, because people were asking me things and I didn't know the answers. So I hope you'll consider buying a copy and giving it to friends or relatives or people who don't agree with you. The most important thing, as Mark was saying, is to get the conversation going. And the video that we made, we did it very, very quickly in a couple of days, is a 20-minute presentation that is a summary of the arguments that are laid out in greater detail in the book. So I think I'll start out with that, and if we could turn off the lights, and I'm premiering this new little gadget here, so let's hope it works, and we will listen to watch the video and then talk. Thank you so much.
Let's talk about the heartbreaking war in Ukraine and what we could do to try to end it. Every day the war rages on, civilians and soldiers are being killed. Millions of Ukrainians have been forced to flee and seek asylum in foreign lands. Schools, hospitals, apartment buildings, and infrastructure have been reduced to rubble. We wrote this book to try to help people make sense of a war that should never have happened, a war that has raged on for months and might well rage on for years, a war that could lead to a nuclear confrontation, a war that must be stopped. We know that people have very different opinions about this conflict, and we hope that our book and this talk will foster respectful dialogue. We have not tried to justify or excuse Russia's invasion of Ukraine because we do not think it is justifiable or excusable. We hope we can help you understand the context, the background, and the actions of all the parties that led to this crisis. As U.S. citizens, we have very little hope of influencing the Russian government, but we should be able to influence our own government, which is why it's so important to look at the role the United States has played in fomenting the conflict. Let's look at two elements of U.S. involvement that we highlight in our book, NATO expansion and the events of 2014. Western leaders call NATO a defensive military alliance, but NATO was formed to defend Western Europe from invasion by the Soviet Union. That mission was accomplished when the Soviet Union disintegrated in 1991. NATO should have been dissolved at the end of the Cold War, along with the Warsaw Pact, which was NATO's counterpart in the Eastern Bloc. Instead, NATO reinvented itself to justify its continued existence. It expanded all the way to Russia's borders, despite many promises that it would not do so, and ignoring warnings from experienced U.S. and Western diplomats that this would lead to a predictable yet entirely avoidable crisis with Russia, as in fact it has. You can see the map showing the various waves of expansion in which NATO incorporated former Soviet republics and Russia's European neighbors. In 2018, the antagonism reached new heights when NATO, under U.S. pressure, publicly promised membership to the former Soviet republics of Ukraine and Georgia. While no definite date was set, NATO began supplying increased levels of military aid and training to Ukraine, including Ukraine in military exercises. So Russia certainly had legitimate concerns about Ukraine's involvement in an ever-expanding military alliance that was encircling Russia with powerful military forces and had already unleashed aggressive wars and occupations in Kosovo in 1999, Afghanistan in 2001, and Libya and Syria in 2011. The other event that served to set the stage for the Russian invasion in 2022 was the coup in Ukraine in 2014. The 2014 upheavals began with massive peaceful protests against the corrupt pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych. Unfortunately, though, these protests turned violent and were co-opted by neo-Nazi groups that refused to go along with an internationally negotiated plan for a political transition, and instead they spearheaded a coup. The extent of U.S. support and involvement in this coup is still shrouded in secrecy, as are previous U.S.-backed coups in Iran, Chile, and many other countries. But a leaked audio tape of Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt exposed their roles as coup managers as they handpicked what positions each of their Ukrainian collaborators would assume in the post-coup government. Although the original peaceful protests in Ukraine were about wanting to join the European Union, Nuland dismissed the European Union's more popular choice for prime minister, Vitaly Klitschko, with her infamous F the EU remark. According to a Gallup poll conducted in April 2014, nearly 50% of Ukrainians rejected the legitimacy of the post-coup government. This led to rebellions in parts of Ukraine that were ethnically and culturally close to Russia. in Crimea, a peninsula on the Black Sea with a mostly Russian-speaking population that was part of Russia from 1783 until 1954, as well as in the eastern provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk. In Odessa, 42 anti-coup protesters were burned to death by a mob on May 2, 2014. The new government in Ukraine was rejected by the parliament in Crimea, and a referendum to rejoin Russia passed overwhelmingly and was accepted by Russia but not recognized by other countries. The provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk also passed referendums declaring themselves independent from Ukraine, leading to a civil war that killed an estimated 14,000 people. Many Ukrainian military units based in this region defected to the self-declared People's Republics or refused to fight their own people. So the Ukrainian government formed new National Guard units to fight the separatists. These included units like the Azov Battalion, recruited from the same neo-Nazi groups that took up arms to spearhead the coup in Kiev in February 2014. The worst fighting of the Civil War ended in February 2015 with the signing of the Minsk II Accord. This was drafted by France, Germany, and Russia, and agreed to by Ukraine and the self-declared republics. It set up a ceasefire and a buffer zone between the warring parties and was monitored by 1,300 monitors and staff from the OSCE, which is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. While the ceasefire largely held from 2015 to 2022, the Ukrainian government failed to implement the political aspects of the Minsk II agreement. It had agreed to grant Donetsk and Luhansk a new autonomous status, but each time the Ukrainian government tried to move forward on this, extreme right-wing forces re-exerted their power and insisted that Ukraine must instead keep fighting to recover its lost territories. NATO and the U.S. also bear responsibility for the failure of Minsk II. Despite officially claiming to support the agreement, NATO and the U.S., under both Trump and Biden, kept building up Ukraine's military, encouraging the Ukrainian government to believe it could eventually recover Donbas and Crimea by force, and that the U.S. and NATO would support that. As tensions were reaching a boiling point in December 2021, Russia took the initiative of drafting two mutual security treaties, one between Russia and the United States and the other between Russia and NATO. These were not take-it-or-leave-it demands, but drafts for negotiation. Unfortunately, the United States and NATO summarily dismissed Russia's proposals. By building up Ukraine's military, promising Ukraine NATO membership, and dismissing negotiations, the U.S. and its allies turned Ukraine into a dangerous weapon in their revived Cold War against Russia. Then, in the days leading up to February's Russia invasion, the OSCE ceasefire monitors documented thousands of explosions around the ceasefire line in Donbas, mostly on the Donetsk and Luhansk side, indicating a major escalation of artillery fire by Ukrainian government forces. So even in the immediate causes of the war, it is deceptive to describe the invasion as unprovoked, as Biden and U.S. officials routinely do. By early 2022, Russia had amassed large military forces near Belarus' border and its own borders with Ukraine, all the while denying that it had plans to invade. It also formally recognized Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics as independent countries. On February 24th, Russia invaded. The invasion was illegal on many counts. It was not an act of self-defense, and it certainly was not authorized by the United Nations. Under international law, including the Kellogg-Briand Pact and the UN Charter, the invasion was an illegal crime of aggression. Russia did not just move its invading forces into Donbas to support the breakaway republics, but it launched offensive towards the capital, Kyiv, and the second largest city, Kharkiv, in the northeast, and into the southern part of Ukraine from Crimea. Western analysts generally agree that Russia must have hoped to take quickly Kyiv and install a friendly government, but it encountered strong resistance from Ukrainian forces and was forced to withdraw from the north. Ukraine's Western neighbors responded to the invasion by granting asylum to millions of refugees, while the U.S. and other NATO countries poured billions of dollars worth of weapons into Ukraine, stepped up their training of Ukrainian military, and provided it with intelligence to accurately attack important Russian targets. There has been little or no accountability for the weapons flooding into Ukraine. There are reports that as little as 30% of them may be reaching the front lines because they are either destroyed by Russian missiles or siphoned off into the black market, where they could end up in the hands of the Islamic State, neo-Nazis, or other dangerous groups around the world. This was precisely why the U.S. Congress prohibited the transfer of U.S. weapons to the Azov Regiment in 2018, as it became a magnet and a hub for international right-wing militant networks. Yet after the Russian invasion, all restraints were lifted, and thousands of tons of powerful and advanced weapons have poured in over the Polish border. There was so little debate about this in the U.S. that when Congress passed an enormous $40 billion package for Ukraine, with most of the money to be spent on more and more lethal weapons for up to another decade, not a single Democrat voted against it, not even Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who cast the lone, wise, and prophetic vote against the disastrous war in Afghanistan in 2001. In our book, we explain the peace negotiations in Turkey in March that could have already ended this war, and the largely unreported role of the U.S. and British governments in killing those talks. The talks during the first month of the war produced the contours of a 15-point peace plan for a ceasefire, a Russia withdrawal, and a future for Ukraine as an independent, peaceful, and neutral country. On March 27th, President Zelensky told a national TV audience, "Our goal is obvious, peace and the restoration of normal life in our native state as soon as possible." Under the draft agreement, Ukraine would neither be a military ally of the United States and NATO, nor of Russia, with no foreign military bases or installations on its territory. Ukraine would get security guarantees from other countries. Russian speakers in Ukraine would be free to speak, read, and study in Russian. And the future of Crimea and Donbas would be determined by an internationally accepted political process during a transition period of several years. But none of that came to pass. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson went to Kyiv on April 9th and told Prime Minister Zelensky that the UK would not be party to any agreement between Ukraine and Russia, and that the collective West, as he called it, saw a chance to press Russia and was determined to make the most of it. Turkish diplomats who had been mediating the ceasefire talks reported that U.S. Defense Secretary Austin delivered a similar message to Zelensky, and that these messages effectively killed their peace efforts. So early hopes for a negotiated peace were dashed, largely as a result of U.S. and British determination to weaken Russia, even at the cost of rivers of Ukrainian blood, in an open-ended war that could last for years. The undermining of ceasefire talks was a tragic lost opportunity. Since the talks were abandoned, the slaughter and destruction has continued, with hundreds of Ukrainians killed every day. Russia has taken control of more territory, and despite the successful Ukrainian counteroffensive, Russia now occupies 20% of Ukraine. The sanctions against Russia have backfired, leading to soaring energy prices worldwide, while reduced grain exports have led to widespread hunger, particularly in the global south. Europe is facing an energy and home heating crisis. Meanwhile, no sign has honestly or publicly explained what its goals are in this war, or why they can possibly justify the total destruction of Ukraine and even the greater danger of nuclear war. Even the old war hawk Henry Kissinger is warning that U.S. policy has blundered to the brink of a world war, with no clear purpose or endgame in sight. He told the Wall Street Journal, "We are at the edge of war with Russia and China on issues which we partly created, without any concept of how this is going to end or what it's supposed to lead to." And here at home, we are told we don't have the funds for a decent healthcare system or free college education or housing for the unhoused. We cannot allow our public funds to be squandered on yet another unwinnable war and an even more all-consuming military budget. Governments in the global South are watching the impacts of this war plunge millions of their people into hunger and famine, while Europe's energy crisis is already sinking the continent into a recession. We in the U.S. have been relatively unscathed by this war compared to many people elsewhere, but we are already facing rising prices which will get worse as the war continues, and the U.S. will not be exempt from the impacts of this looming global recession. With climate chaos jeopardizing the very future of life on this planet, this war is derailing our efforts to confront the climate crisis. Instead of a Green New Deal, we are now watching a mad scramble to produce more oil, gas, and coal as energy companies reap record profits from their disaster capitalism. And while the climate heats up and governments and corporations shift their already inadequate climate plans into reverse, Russia and the U.S. are threatening us with yet another existential disaster, a nuclear apocalypse. We understand that some people may disagree with our analysis of this conflict, but hopefully we can all agree that we must do whatever we can to bring this war to an end. And that's why Code Pink is part of a coalition called Peace in Ukraine. We pressure our members of Congress and the White House to call for negotiations. We call on the media to promote the voice of peacemakers. We distribute our messages via social media, and we educate the public, including getting our book into libraries and classrooms. And we encourage you to join us. We must act now to say, stop the bloodshed, stop the bombing, stop the madness. We must work together to demand a ceasefire and negotiations, not more war. Thank you.
So, yes, I hope the video brought up some issues for you that we can talk about. We obviously go over the issues of how we feel that NATO has provoked Russia. Tomorrow there is going to be a new provocation, which is NATO nuclear war games are going to start. So imagine war games that are simulating the annihilation of Russia with nuclear weapons. And the head of NATO said, well, it would be irresponsible for us not to go ahead with these war games because then Russia would think that somehow we're being intimidated by Russia. So here we have the next level of intimidation. Talking about nuclear war, it was interesting that the president mentioned nuclear annihilation for the first time, not in a policy discussion, but at a fundraiser at the home of one of the Murdochs, when he mentioned that this was indeed a possibility. One would have hoped that he would have talked about nuclear annihilation as part of a discussion of why the U.S. needed to change its policy so that a nuclear war would not be more likely. But no, he didn't do that. When we talk about the consequences, the possible consequences of this war, the nuclear one is certainly one that is all too real and we shouldn't think about it as a bluff on the part of Putin. This is the anniversary now of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when John F. Kennedy realized it was important to talk to Khrushchev. And the negotiations ended not only with the Russians taking their missiles out of Cuba, but something the American people tend to not know about is that it was in exchange for the U.S. removing missiles from Turkey. And one thing that JFK said at that time was that it is important when you are confronting a nuclear power not to leave them with the choice of a humiliating defeat or a nuclear war. And that's exactly what Biden and NATO are doing right now. I just started this book tour, and I started by talking at universities. And what I found is that when I talked about nuclear war, there was a lot of blank faces. And that young people really didn't know. They didn't have a gut feeling about it. They didn't grow up in an age where nuclear war weapon had been used, where nuclear war was a possibility, where people and children in school were told how to hide under their desks. But the younger generation is concerned about the climate. And I think it's so important to talk about the climate crisis in relationship to this war. Because what I found is at the beginning of the Russian invasion, many of the climate groups got together and said, we have to join and push for the sanctions against Russian energy. And you see Greenpeace and others stopping ships in the ocean that were carrying Russian oil. And they thought that this invasion of Russia would lead to the Western European countries moving at a quicker pace towards green energy. And while indeed in the longer run that might be the case, in the shorter run what has happened is that they are scrambling to find other sources of energy, and that means more dirty energy being produced. Dirty oil, dirty gas, frack gas, more coal being used, nuclear plants that were going to be decommissioned, not being decommissioned. And another issue is the focus on the climate. We are going to have the COP27 talks coming up very soon in Egypt. And I can't imagine any new significant agreements being reached at a time when the U.S. can't talk to Russia, when the U.S. is barely talking to China. We need all the countries to come together to focus on the climate crisis. The other issue is about the money. I just, with my co-author, analyzed it. Every speech that was given at the General Assembly during its meeting in September, and we pulled out the speeches of 66 heads of state. When they meet every year, they get 15 minutes. It's their 15 minutes of fame. They have a chance to say what they want to the world community. 66 heads of state took time out of their 15 minutes to talk about Ukraine. Basically, what they said is that they condemned the Russian invasion, but they weren't interested in taking sides. What they wanted is the side of peace. What they wanted to see is an end to the crisis. And it was particularly heartbreaking to hear from some of the nations that were small island nations whose very existence is being threatened by the climate crisis. And they said something to the effect that you, the global community, and particularly the wealthier nations, had promised us back in 2010 that you were going to have a global climate fund of $100 billion. Over a decade has passed, and only $10 billion has been put into that fund. Yet already, before a year has even passed, you've put that much money into the war in Ukraine. And this tells us something very important about your priorities. The head of Pakistan got up and said a third of our country is underwater. Our people are dying. Our people are suffering. We need help, and the help is not coming in. And the consequences are also about hunger, because with the attention of the world and the global resources being diverted, the money is not going into places like Afghanistan, like Yemen, like many parts of Africa where there was already a hunger crisis. And now with the price of grains going up so much, there is even greater hunger in many parts of the world. So this war has consequences that are rippling out across the entire globe, which is why so many of those heads of states said, we want you to sit down and find a solution. And when you look at the population of those nations, it is the majority of people in the world, because it includes not only small island nations, but the major countries like China, like India, like Indonesia, even Brazil, with a right-wing president, came out and said the same thing. You have to find a solution. One thing I hear constantly, though, is people saying, you can't talk to Putin. He's a madman. You can't negotiate with him. Well, I think there are many answers to that. One is to say, let's try and see what happens. Another is to say, there have been negotiations going on. Already, there have been negotiations, some of them quite successful, for example, to get a lot of that grain out of Ukraine to the countries that desperately need it. There have been negotiations to get inspectors into the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. There have been negotiations about prisoner swaps. In fact, there have been about 16 prisoner swaps. And imagine how difficult it is to have a prisoner swap. The logistics that have to be created, the trust that has to be created that both sides are going to comply. And some of them have been quite large, with hundreds of prisoners being exchanged. The other thing is to talk about the talks that were going on in late March and early April, when both the Russians and the Ukrainians said that there was very significant movement in those talks. And we see how the Prime Minister of the UK and Secretary Austin from the U.S. helped to quash those talks. Now, some people say to me, that's not true. Where is your proof about that? And I say, you know, the proof is that right now, the position of the Ukrainian government is that Zelensky held created a decree saying, we will not talk to the Russians. We will not talk to Putin. And Biden has said, we will not talk to Putin. I think it is the height of irresponsibility on the part of our president not to be talking to Putin. It is the height of irresponsibility for our Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, who is supposed to be the number one diplomat in our country, not to be talking on a regular basis to his counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Russia. There are some people who are coming out now to stake a position about the need for talks and negotiations. And one of them is Donald Trump. Now, we might laugh at this, but let's think about it for a minute. Donald Trump said that if he were president, this war would not be happening because he would talk to Putin, and that Biden refuses to communicate with Putin. Donald Trump says that this war is affecting the entire world and there need to be negotiations. Donald Trump is going out to his rallies and using the social media to say this war must end. It will only end at the negotiating table. He even put himself forward as a negotiator. So we might snicker, we might laugh, but you know what? Donald Trump says this because he knows that it has resonance among his base. There are also Republicans in Congress who are speaking out against the war. When a $40 billion package was introduced into Congress, and not one Democrat stood up to say no. Not one Democrat stood up to say, even like Senator Rand Paul said, where is the accountability? Not one Democrat questioned that. There were 57 Republicans who did in the House and 11 Republicans in the Senate. Some of them had kooky reasons why they didn't want to approve that money. They wanted us instead to focus our weaponry on the real adversary, which is China. Some of them said we wanted our military to go where we need them to protect our border in Mexico. But some of them made a lot of sense and said, we have needs at home that are not being met, and we don't understand why it's in the national security interest of the United States to put billions and billions of dollars in this war, and we don't understand what the end game is. Raise your hand if you heard Tulsi Gabbard this week. Well, so those of you who didn't, let me tell you what she did. You know, Tulsi Gabbard was a presidential candidate. Tulsi Gabbard, when she dropped out of the race, she endorsed Bernie Sanders. Tulsi Gabbard was a Democrat. Tulsi Gabbard came out this week and she said, I am leaving the Democratic Party because it is run now by a bunch of warmongers. And she went on to give very eloquent reasons, and she herself is in the military, about why this is so wrong, why it is so bad. She went on to give all kinds of other messages that I found horrific, that were anti-LGBTQ, that were anti-immigrant, all kinds of other things. I feel she's positioning herself to be vice president for Trump or whoever runs on the Republican side. But the point I'm making is that she got millions of hits on her speech. She got on the Joe Rogan show that some of you might know reaches millions of people. They are reaching millions with a message that this is Joe Biden's war. This is the Democrats' war. And this is hurting working families in this country. The inflation that we are feeling and that is going to get greater is attributed in large part to this war. They are saying that the prices are going to go back up at the fuel pump because of this war and the sanctions on Russia. They are saying that the prices of groceries that you are seeing increases are because of this war. It might not have an impact so quickly on the November elections, but it's going to come back to bite the Democrats, especially if this war drags on and on towards the next presidential elections. So there are many, many reasons for us to say we need to build a new peace movement. We need to get out there all over this country and say that this war is bad for the people of Ukraine, that we care about the people of Ukraine. We want to see them an end so they can stop dying, so they can come back to their homes, so they can rebuild their country. We want to see an end to this war because we don't want more people going hungry around the world. We don't want more dirty energy around the world. And because we don't want extreme right people, whether it's in the United States or around Europe, where we're seeing them gain more and more traction, taking advantage of this conflict. So it's in the interest of anybody who cares about people and the planet to help build, rebuild an invigorated anti-war movement that can put pressure on the Democrats, the Republicans, and the president to say the only way to stop this war is at the negotiating table and to call a ceasefire, and that's what we demand. Thank you.
That was a portion of a presentation by CodePink co-founder Medea Benjamin a couple of weeks ago at Kerouac Cafe here in Columbus. Her book, Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, is available in paperback now. We'll have part two of her presentation next week. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care.